You're listening to the podcast, So You Want to Be a Writer, with Valerie Koo and Allison Tate. Valerie is an author, journalist, and national director of the Australian Writers' Centre, which is one of the world's leading providers of online and classroom courses for people who want to get published and write with confidence.
Allison Tate is a freelance writer, blogger, and author of the best-selling series, The Mapmaker Chronicles. She has more than 20 years professional writing experience.
Each week they explore the world of writing, publishing and blogging to bring you news and opportunities, advice on how to succeed in the world of writing, interviews with top writers and much more. With students enrolling from all over the world, you can find out more about the Australian Writers' Centre at writerscentre.com.au.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 202 of So You Want to Be a Writer. My name's Valerie Koo and I'm here with Allison Tate. How are you, Al? What's happening in Al's world?
School holidays, Val. Two words. School holidays. That's what's happening in my world.
To no end. The four boys across the road. Do we not just talk about this?
I can't believe it's been 10 weeks since our last conversation about school holidays because it's Yeah, they roll around so quickly in some ways. But anyway, here we are. That's me. I'm school holidaying onwards. The boys are currently shooting a blockbuster movie.
Oh, cool.
About a trampoline championship and on a far distant planet.
Love it. Love it. Mm-hmm. In a far distant planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure. The far distant planet is in the garage, I think. So.
Okay. I just love the joy in your voice when school holidays rolls around. But anyway, I just want to give a big shout out to all of the people who came to the meetups for the members of the Freelance Writing Masterclass program in Sydney and Melbourne last week. It was the first time we did the meetup in Melbourne. And I want to give a big shout out to those guys who came to that, in particular, Shannon's partner, who didn't come to it because he's not part of the program. Shannon is. But Shannon's partner, hello, Shannon's partner. He started writing as a result of hearing us bang on this podcast.
I think we've got to come up with a better term than bang on. I think it's sorry. Wax lyrical, talk so, eloquently.
Yes, talks we about yes, that's speak right. Eloquently. He started penning his literary tome after hearing us speak very eloquently about the world of writing and publishing. So we want to give a big shout out to you and say, you know, good on you for A, choosing Shannon as a partner. He's really cool. I finally met him for the first time. But even more importantly, getting your writing on. That's so cool. And we want to encourage you to keep on doing it.
Yes, absolutely. We do.
Yes.
Cheer squad here. Cheerleading. Yes. I'm waving pom-poms as we speak.
Me too. Yes, exactly. Not quite, but I'm pretending. Okay. So let's move on to, let's see, the world of writing and publishing, Al.
Well, what a good place to start, Val.
Well, I found this post called The blog is called The Manuscript Shredder, but the post is called What's Wrong with Slipping Backstory into Conversations? And I am seeing this a lot amongst rookie writers, and I do see it on, you know, new writers on things like Wattpad. I see it in fan fiction, that sort of thing. And that is where there's not only a lot of dialogue used, but the dialogue is used essentially for exposition, for telling the story of why they are there or telling the story of how the butler did it or whatever. And admittedly, it's easier to fall into this trap, especially if you watch a lot of television or movies, because that's, in fact, the only way for them to do it. And particularly cop shows, you'll find out heaps of stuff about forensic activity and the criminal mind through dialogue, because it's very hard to express, you know, an inner monologue on screen, and the only way to do that is via dialogue. So it's very easy when you're writing a novel, when you're writing fiction as opposed to a screenplay, to fall into that trap because it's what you see on television. But in fact, it doesn't work well that way on the page. It does sound like you're unnatural, and it does sound like you're labouring the point. It works on TV because the audience is distracted by other things. They're distracted by the fact that they're walking down the steps, or that they're drinking a cup of coffee, or they're doing something else apart from the dialogue. But when it's just there on the page, that is a reader reads it and goes, I wouldn't say that in real life. Or that's the feeling that they would get. Anyway, what do you think, yes. Al? Do you see this?
Oh, I do see. It's funny you say that, though, because I just finished reading. Do you know where you often see it too? And I think readers of crime fiction would probably agree with me on this. You actually see it quite a lot written in crime fiction, because you particularly get it when you get the sort of towards the end and you're getting the sort of, you know, you're getting the solution, and you've got the bad guy, you know, sitting in – so it works two ways. You've either got the bad guy sitting in a chair and the detective, you know, asks just the question that, you know, releases the floodgates, and yes. the bad guy tells the detective the whole story of what happened, you know, from start to finish with the, you know, and then of course I did this, and then of course I did that, and blah, blah, blah. Or you see it the other way around, where the bad guy says, you have no idea what happened, and the detective – you know, gives the full story of the solution to the crime, you know, in pages and pages and pages yes. of dialogue, like this full on narrative. And it's sort of, I guess it's a kind of, it's more of an accepted thing in crime fiction, because it's a little bit old fashioned, but it's definitely, you know, how it happens a lot of the time. Well, I saw usually, and you often see it, Sherlock Holmes did a lot, yeah? It was a bit like, then I saw the envelope and blah, blah, blah. So you do see it there, but it's sort of the dialogue can be a great way to actually show what's happening. It can be a great way to get information across to the reader without, you know, in that sort of show, don't tell sort of way. But it has to be in natural conversation. It yes. can't be, well, as you know, in this particular post, ML Keller, who is the author of the piece, describes it as you know dialogue, because yeah. you could easily insert that phrase at the beginning of it. Well, as you know, I'm working on this because our greatest rival XYZ is, and you've got to think about how people would actually talk if as she explains in her post, if the two people who are having the conversation both know that their biggest rival is Apple, they're not going to actually drop that into the conversation. That's not a natural conversation for them to be having, because they know, and so they don't need to discuss Apple as their greatest rival. So
they don't need to mention the word Apple.
They might talk about, and they're probably not even going to say, well, you know, our greatest rival. They're not going to talk about that either. The sort of nature of the competitiveness with that other business will come up in a much more natural fashion. So I think this comes back to, and we've talked about this several times, I think this comes back to reading your dialogue out loud. I think it comes back to actually reading it and thinking, is this how people actually talk to each other, or am I just having them talk like this because I want to say something as the author?
Yeah, absolutely. And also a good example from this post is they give one example of, good morning, Joan. Looks like you've been here all night. What are you working on? And as opposed to, morning, Joan, same outfit, I see. So yeah. that implies quite a number of things. So it's without spelling it out. So that's an important thing for particularly, I think, newbie writers to consider, because I know that when I'm reading some manuscripts and there's just a whole lot of pages and pages of dialogue, I do often read it with an analytical eye and feel, you know, there's different ways of going about explaining all of that information, and perhaps you should try it. Let's move on to a post called Historical Novels, Your Research To-Do List. This is from Writer Unboxed. And, of course, for all of these things, we'll put the link in the show notes, which you can find at soyouwanttobeawriter.com.au. And this is a cool post because it's literally that. It's a research to-do list on what some of the things that you should do if you are writing a historical novel. And one of the things it says is start with historical non-fiction. So go to, you know, books and other types of research tools that you can find that are non-fiction, that aren't, because perhaps the fiction that you are reading may not be an accurate representation of the era. So go to non-fiction and see what you can glean from there in order to get a start and get the right base, not a inaccurate base, in a sense. The other thing that they say is fall down Google, the Google or Pinterest black hole, then dig yourself out. And that's not just Google, but that is things like we've previously discussed Trove, that's T-R-O-V-E, where I, you know, almost fell down that hole the other day. Well, I did fall down that hole, and it was at least a couple of hours before I realised I'm not even meant to be doing this. But it was so interesting reading the newspapers of the day of whatever it was that I was researching, you know, from the early 1900s. So go and do that. I'm a big believer in going to non-fiction historical documents before then creating your own fictional world. So, and there's a bunch of other tips on this list as well, including make timelines, which I think is really, really useful if you are in a particular era and your story spans maybe a couple of years. Put some of the markers of, you know, this is when JFK got shot, or this is when, you know, women got the vote, or just certain markers that may or may not have anything to do with your main story, but a little hint, a little mention of that historic event, just very subtly, may help underpin your story into that era, I think, important.
Yes, most definitely. I think there's another thing here where she talks about getting your hands on memoirs and letters and things from people of the time, because it gives you get more of an idea of what a normal day is like, what people are kind of talking about, the kinds of things that they're reading, those sorts of things. Like if you think about, you know, letters as they used to be, you know, people, I remember when I was a kid, I used to write these long and involved letters to my cousins. You know, admittedly, we were all about 10, so, you know, the level of the quality of information was probably slightly not that great. But we talked about the kinds of books we were reading, the kinds of films that we went to see, because it was the only kind of form of communication we had at that stage. So letters from the time can be really helpful for finding details, because, of course, we've talked in the past about, you know, how a lot of scene setting and a lot of place in a book is all about the detail. It's not actually about the big picture stuff and the sort of, you know, that sort of thing. It's actually the tiny little details make all the difference. But yes. I would also, there she talks about also keying in on language. And she was saying how, you know, when she was reading through memoirs and letters, and when she was reading through fiction and through nonfiction, you know, if she came across slang terms or language that she felt, you know, was very much, you know, of the era that she was writing about, she wrote it down, and she ended up using those sorts of words and phrases in her work. And I would also add that you need to be really careful about that. And the reason for that is that, yes, you want to actually make your era authentic. So you're not going to use, you know, current slang in your sort of work. But I read a historical novel not that long ago that contained a lot of slang from the era, and it was very much of the era. Like, I get it, like it was really, but there was so much of it that I found it really annoying. I found it really, really annoying, because it's kind of like, yes, if you think about it in day-to-day terms, we do use slang, but we don't use it in every single conversation that we have. We don't actually use those kinds of words and phrases all the time. And I think that if you have a character that is consistently constantly using one or two phrases to try and make it feel authentic, it actually ends up really, really annoying for the reader. So think about it. Like, if the judicious use of slang, absolutely go for it, because it really helps to kind of to bring about a place. But don't overdo it, because all you end up doing is making your modern reader irritated.
Yeah,
I'm
absolutely.
Just speaking from experience here.
Yeah, definitely. So let us move on to our next post. This is from The Right Life. I really liked this one. It's called The Three Biggest pitch mistakes this editor sees every day. And it's speaking about freelance writing pitches, as in for articles in magazines, newspapers, and online publications, not pitches to fiction editors. So I like this because one of the first ones is so spot on, and I see many freelancers make this mistake, and it is do your exploring before you pitch. So what they're referring to is when you receive a pitch from an editor, I mean, not from an editor, when an editor receives a pitch for a freelance writer about whatever topic, you know, I'm going to explore what it's like to do blah, 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 blah. I'm going to explore the arguments about, you know, stem cells or whatever. And what this post is saying that is a writer who wants to explore an idea is a writer who doesn't know what they want to write yet. And they say these are the kinds of pitches that sit in their inbox for days because the writer usually wants to explore something interesting, but I don't know if that exploration will result in a good story. And I see this from time to time as well, and this is what I coach and mentor people to do, is don't say that you're going to explore it. You need to have done a fair chunk of the exploration beforehand so you can see whether the story has legs. Otherwise, an editor will be hard-pressed to commission you because you might come up with nothing. So, yeah, definitely do your exploring before you pitch. And the other one that I love in these set of tips is if you're pitching a personal narrative, put the narrative into the pitch. So these days in particular, there's a little bit more first-person kind of articles where you are writing it in that memoir style, in a first-person point of view. However, you are, you know, making sure that it's fleshed out and meaty by supporting it with right research or academic studies or experts or whatever, but it opens with a first-person experience. And that is becoming more common and more acceptable than it was in the past. But one of the things that people, the editors need to see is how you write that, how you write in that style. So this post says, if you're pitching a personal narrative, make sure your pitch includes the narrative, as in the kind, the type of language that they would expect to see in a finished piece, you know, so that they are getting almost a taste of the kind of first-person memoir style piece that you're going to write. I think that that is very, very important.
Very true.
I think.
Are these among the most common sorts of problems that you see when you do your mentoring and masterclasses and things?
Interestingly, a very common, so yes, they are, but a common problem is people sometimes, they do get the pitch nailed or come close to it, right? So they're actually quite good at the pitching side of it. But the bizarre thing that I have noticed in certain situations is they've nailed the pitch, the editor has said yes, or, you know, at least said that they'd consider it if it's not a firm yes. But then they deliver an article that does not actually deliver on the pitch.
Oh, yeah. It's funny you say that because I knew you were going to say that because that's one of the things that used to drive me crazy when I was working as a features editor. They would pitch a story and then give you a completely different story.
Yes. Bizarre.
And you go, why have you done this? Well, I couldn't get the story I wanted or, you know, whatever. But, you know, it's I thought this one would be better. Well, no, because this is not what I'm expecting.
Exactly. It's not the one that you agreed to and planned your whole editorial schedule around. So
yeah,
it's bizarre. And so sometimes, yeah, it is those excuses. I've heard those excuses before. But sometimes I think I've also experienced situations where people have just forgot what was in the original pitch and they haven't bothered to read it again. They just know that it's about a particular topic and they know, start researching that topic. But they need to put their pitch next to them, you know, printed out on a piece of paper or something, stuck on their wall next to them as they're writing the story so that they make sure that they are fulfilling essentially what they promised. So I'm seeing that as well as a bit of a, as a bit of a common thing. But anyway, let us move on to our giveaway this week.
Oh, how exciting.
It is exciting, Al. Do you know why, know why it's exciting?
It's always exciting, Val, as far as I know, always.
It's particularly exciting this week because we have three copies of The Book of Secrets by A.L. Tate. Oh, I wonder who that could be.
Ooh. Wow. Wow. Okay.
Otherwise known as Alison Tate, AWC presenter and co-host of this podcast. So, of course, this is the first book of the new Adaban Cipher series, a thrilling new adventure from, the best-selling author of the Mapmaker Chronicles. Now, this is so cool. We have three copies to give away. You don't win all three, you win one. Three of you will win one. And one copy each. And if you want to win, then go to writercentre.com.au/win and entries close on the 4th of October. But don't worry, if you're listening in the future, there'll be some other competition for you to enter. However, you will miss out if you miss this one. So go to writercentre.com.au/win to win one of three copies of The Book of Secrets by A.L. Tate. Very exciting. But let's move on to...
Let's move on.
Are you ready for the word of the week, Al?
Oh, it couldn't get more exciting. I thought for a minute there that there could be no further excitement in my life, and yet here it is.
Okay. Have you heard of this word or have you ever used this word? Etiolated. Etiolated. That's no. E-T-I-O-L-A-T-A-D. Etiolated.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, good. So this is what happens when a plant goes pale due to the lack of sunlight. I have many plants like this, many, because I'm not a green thumb and I don't pay enough attention to my plants. But you might not talk to people about plants generally, as I don't, so you might use it in a sentence like this. She emerged from her week at home with the flu with an etiolated look.
Mm-hmm. But probably I wouldn't use it like that. But if anyone can use that in an actual relevant sentence, then please, you need to tag us.
Definitely tag us because I would love to see this word out there in the wild. All right, let's move on to who's our writer in residence this week, Al?
Oh, look, I had a fantastic chat this week with Tori DeRoche, and it's a really great story because she self-published a memoir and then she got a direct message on Twitter from a Hollywood producer who wanted to make a movie of her memoir. And because of that, she then got a literary agent who sold the first memoir into, like, you know, various territories and it went gangbusters. But there was a delay in publication, and then while she was having to promote the memoir, the happy ending that she had written into the memoir was kind of falling apart around her. I know. So we had this excellent chat because she has a new book out now. We had this excellent chat about the perils of writing memoir and also, you know, a whole range of stuff, you know, about self-publishing and about traditional publishing and all of the things. So it was a very fun chat. Tori DeRoche is the author of two books, Love with a Chance of Drowning, which she self-published in 2011 as Swept, Love with a Chance of Drowning, and was then traditionally published in 2013 and optioned for film. Her new book, The Warrior's Guide to the End of the World, is about what happened after the love in question did in fact drown. So, welcome to the program, Tori.
Hi, Alison. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's go back to the beginning because you and I actually, you know, technically met when in an online-y kind of way back in the day, 2011, when you first self-published Swept, Love with a Chance of Drowning. So can you sort of sum up for us the story of how that book came to be self-published and then traditionally published?
Yeah, so I wrote that book having never written anything before. I'd never published anything before, and I wrote this manuscript, and I knew it'd be very difficult to try to get it published, but I started by trying to get an agent, and I gave myself a deadline of 6 months to try to get an agent, and I pitched all around Australia and all in the US and just had no luck with it, so I'll hit the button on self-publishing. But in that process, I had also built up a platform online, a blog and social media and stuff like that. So when I did self-publish, it kind of, it got a little bit of buzz and it got out there, and within 2 weeks, I think it was, I started to get offers from, the first was actually a Hollywood film producer who wanted to buy the option straight to the top with that one, which is awesome. I thought it was like, yeah, it was a Twitter direct, like DM. Somebody sends me a message like, oh, I'm a Hollywood producer and can you send me a copy of your book? I'm like, this sounds really weird. But it was all legit, and I also got an interest from a UK publisher. And so when I had those two offers in hand, I was able to just go straight to my agent of choice and sign with her. And then we pitched to the US, and it sold in a preemptive offer, and then it went to auction here in Australia and sold to Penguin. And so we ended up with, I think, five different deals and translations. So, wow. Yeah.
So pretty much the dream run as far as, like, did you know much about self-publishing when you hit the button, as you said?
I'd done a lot of just online research. So I come from a background in visual communications. I studied graphic design and illustration and photography, and that all really came in handy when it, so like I made a little book trailer, for example, that just told the story really simply. And I think that those sorts of little marketing devices just helped get it out there. So I didn't know about self-publishing, but I taught myself and just sort of intuitively felt my way through it and, you know, tested what was working and what wasn't working and stuff like that.
So were the results of that kind of more than you expected, or like in the sense of hello, Hollywood producer, you know, auctions, fights over the rights, you know, I mean, that's kind of an unusual outcome, just quietly.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty weird. Like even to this day when I talk about it, it sounds like I'm telling somebody else's story. I feel like I feel a little bit guilty like telling the story because I feel like it's not my story and then I've just appropriated it from somebody else. So yeah, it's totally weird, you know, and as it was, even when the book launched and I was like, you know, I had a Penguin put billboards, like big backlit billboards of my book cover in airport lounges all around the country. And it was just like, I felt like, oh my God, I had massive imposter syndrome. Like someone's going to find out that I just self-published this book and like tricked my way into this whole thing, you know.
That's funny, isn't it? So there you are with your imposter syndrome. Now, when all this happened, were you still, because, you know, it's about your story of, you know, basically setting sail into the sunset. Were you still on your boat and doing all this kind of stuff while all this sort of publishing stuff was happening, or where were you by this stage?
No, I'd been living in Melbourne for, I think, 3 or 4 years at that point. So we'd returned to Melbourne after sailing and, you know, settled down in a house, and I'd written the book over pretty much the like 3 or 4 years just slowly. So settled in Melbourne, and but it was, the relationship was kind of hitting a bit of trouble at that point because he was a sailor and an adventurer, and I was like, you know, there writing my book and really very settled in that life. And so like just as the book was launching, it's like the relationship was sort of starting to hit trouble.
Troubled waters, as they say.
Yes, deep trouble waters.
Yes, yeah, so I actually read a blog post you wrote recently that about this, and I'm going to put that in the show notes because it was a terrific post, because you'd written this memoir with the happy ending and then real life kind of wasn't really matching up, and yet there you were, you know, promoting the book, the relationship is falling apart, you had some other stuff going on in your life, of course, which was difficult as well. And so, you know, were you at that point sort of thinking, I guess my question is this, can you share with listeners some of your thoughts on the pros and cons of writing so closely about your life? Because you write the story and then it may not come out for, you know, as you say, a couple of years, and then you're out there, and the obviously the idea is that you're going to promote this book, and which is not always an easy thing to do when it's a story that maybe is not what you're actually living anymore.
Yeah, that is the really difficult part about memoir, because the book, by the time it actually came out in the traditionally published sense, it was close to a 10-year-old story or a 9-year-old story. Mm. And I think that, you know, that's often the case for memoir. We're writing about the past and there's a very, very long delay in between the events themselves and the promotion. For me, it works out because I'm a bit of a procrastinator. So I sort of think to myself, like, oh, I'll just write this thing now and I'll deal with the consequences later, which serves me quite well in the writing process. But, you know, it does come back to haunt me later. And it was hard. And I'm not going to say tell you that it wasn't hard or that, you know, I didn't doubt whether or not it was the right decision. But ultimately, I think that stories need to be told. And I get so many people coming to me, as I'm sure you do too, as a writer, saying like, oh, I've got this story that I really want to tell. And there's so many people who have lived these experiences or have these ideas that never tell them and they never put them out there. And, you know, you deal with a bit of short-term awkwardness when, you know, at publicity time in situations like this. But I like to think that when I'm an old lady looking back on my life, I will be proud of the fact that I got the stories out of me and I put them out into the world. And I, you know, I tried to take a bigger, like a wider lens approach to it all of like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. It's, you know, I'm going to die one day. I may as well tell the stories.
Get the story out there.
Yeah. Just do it.
All right. So when you start writing a memoir, like where did you start with regards to say, have you approached the two books that you, because you've got a new book out now, which is called The Warrior's Guide to the End of the World. Did you approach the writing of those two memoirs in the same way or has your process, you know, changed and developed?
Yeah, very, very different because the first one I really didn't know how to write. I had to teach myself how to write a book. And so I've actually got a photo of me with my pile of printed drafts and it's kind of chest high. Just printing it out and trying to figure out, you know, how to do it. And I wrote that manuscript. I finished the whole manuscript and got it to, you know, as close to perfect before I submitted that one. Whereas the second book, I submitted off proposal. So I wrote the chapter outlines and sort of figured out the whole, I plotted the whole thing and where it would all fall in the actual layout of the book and wrote it to that format. So it felt a lot easier the second time around. I had obviously a lot more experience and I had a roadmap. So, yeah, very, very different.
And did you, when the first book was traditionally published, so it had gone out as a self-published book, did you have to then rework it at all for the traditional publishing process? Was there more editing to do or did they pretty much run it as it was?
There was a little bit of editing. Penguin wanted to run it as is, but my editor in the US, which was Hyperion, they wanted to just add a few little bits and pieces. It was light edits, really. Mm. So, but I had worked with my sister's an editor, so I'd worked with her the whole way through, and then I'd also hired a proofreader. So,
right.
it was to a pretty polished stage when I self-published out of, you know, a lot of effort on my part.
Yeah. Okay. And you've gone with, so the publishing route with the new one, the new book is also traditionally published. Is that correct?
I have traditionally published it in the US, but in the rest of the world, I've self-published the digital book.
Okay.
And yeah, so I've gone hybrid.
Why did you take that route?
Partly because we've only sold the US rights and it's launch time has come around, and because so much of my effort goes into this digital platform, I just wanted to make sure that I'm like capitalizing off the efforts that I'm putting in online. So we could sit around waiting for more, you know, the rest of the countries to sell. But yeah, I thought I'd just give this a try, like a hybrid option. It's something that I've been curious about. If you selling it in the US, that's the biggest market, and I'm going to get a lot of publicity out of that sort of center point. And what happens if I then self-publish and elsewhere? And it's an experiment.
So you've retained at this stage, then, like I'm just thinking of the logistics of this, the digital rights outside of the US, and have.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Because that's the kind of thing you've got to keep an eye on if you're going to do that, don't you? You have to look at what rights you've sold into what territories and how you can best, I guess, you know, use those rights to your own advantage. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah. You don't want to be double publishing because you'll get into trouble with your publisher. But a lot of people will sell their worldwide rights to one publisher, and in which case you don't have that option. But my agents tend to negotiate, you know, district-specific rights just so that, because you end up with, I guess you end up with better deals that way.
Mm-hmm. And more options, that's right.
More options.
All right, so tell us about your new book. Tell us what it's about and where it came from and how long it took you to write and all of that fun detail stuff that we love so much.
So The Warrior's Guide to the End of the World is my story of how I walked through Italy and then India. At that time of my life after I had gone through this breakup that was really I was launching the book and I – and my father was passing away and I was going through this terrible breakup and it was just like I hit this absolute rock bottom with it. And so I was wandering around Europe, not really knowing, you know, what to do with myself and sort of feeling like all hope was lost when I crossed paths with this woman named Masha, who was in the process of walking around the world in a series of pilgrimages. And she was alone and she said to me, you know, why don't you come join me just for a day? Just come and walk with me for a day. So I put on some really bad shoes. That's all I had in my bag. And I just started walking with her. And one day turned to 2 days and 3 days. And then I got really terrible tendonitis and had to buy a bike to keep going for a little while. And we walked through Tuscany together, just like drinking wine and, you know, eating fruit. And it was all really magical. And I just, through the process of that, I found this way to sort of unravel my grief and unravel my, this catastrophizing that I've always done in worst case, like just imagining worst case scenarios. And I found this way to be really deeply present with just through this sort of communion with my own body and the world around me. And so from Italy, we went to India and spent 23 days walking through India in the footsteps of Gandhi. And that was a very different experience, of course, because it was dusty and difficult and dangerous. And so like it gave me this opportunity to test this kind of sanctuary that I'd found inside of myself through that rhythm of walking, this kind of mindfulness through walking. So that's really the story. It's like, despite its kind of heavy themes, it is a pretty lighthearted story and just a bit of a fun adventure, but at its heart, it's a roadmap out of dark places that we, you know, all inevitably find ourselves in at some point in life.
And do you, like, did you, okay, at what point did you think to yourself, this could be another book? And also, do you keep a journal or diary as you were sort of going so that you could I'm just wondering how you keep track of the feelings and the thoughts and the, you know, the day-to-day experiences so that you can then bring them together into a memoir.
I kept in a diary through India because it was just so surreal that I felt like I wanted to document it. But ordinarily, no. I mean, I write emails to people and they tend to be my way of tracking events. And so when it comes time to writing a book, if I do decide I want to write a book about this time in my life, then I can kind of do a bit of investigation through, you know, a collection of the photography that I've taken with my phone or emails that I've sent to my mother or, you know, like stuff I put on Facebook. It's like being a bit of a detective of your own life. But I didn't know it was going to be another book, and I think that I don't know, with memoir it's hard because you don't really know if there's a story and anything and where something's going to emerge. But I felt after we finished this India pilgrimage, I could just see the picture of it all in my head from where I'd come from to where I got to through this process. And it just felt like a full story to tell. So it was at that point at the end of the journey where I thought, I think this could probably be a book.
Okay. And so then did you sort of put together a proposal for your agent at that point of, you know, what you thought it might be?
Yeah, I did. So my agent, who is no longer my agent, she left the industry, but I absolutely loved her, so it was a very sad loss. that she was going to meet with, she had a meeting with Hachette, and it was in, I think at the time it was like 2 weeks away or maybe 3 weeks away. And she said to me, I've got this meeting with this editor. Can you put a proposal together for me, you know, for a new story in 3 weeks? And it, that's a ridiculously short deadline for a 50-page document. I think it was actually 80 pages, but I just decided to do it, and I went through this kind of manic stage of writing, and it was quite intense, actually. I got this full-on sort of, I don't know, just burst of inspiration where I just wrote, and I there was one day where I wrote 7,000 words of outline, you know. So it's like writing 7,000 words of just straight-up prose is kind of pretty full on. Like that's a full on day, but outlining, it's like big picture stuff. So I just pumped it out, and I wrote the outline for it, and it all just came together, and it, all the puzzle pieces slotted in, and I got the proposal done and sent it off, and yeah. And then my agent left the industry, and I had to start again with a new agent, and it took a while, but we got there at
and
the
there's
end.
There's always a good publishing story like that somewhere in the background, isn't there? Always. Fantastic. Yeah. What about your blog? You have a blog called The Fearful Adventurer, which you've kind of more or less maintained, although I think we discussed earlier before the podcast. I don't like to let people know that we have conversations before the podcast, but anyway, that you had a bit of a break from it and now you're back, and it's called The Fearful Adventurer. Mm-hmm. Do you use your blog as a way of kind of documenting your thoughts, or is that how do you use your blog, I guess?
Not so much documenting my thoughts, because so when, for example, I was going through the breakup, it was a really, really personal time, obviously, and I was in a terrible place. And I went and met with my editor at Penguin, and I think that, like, my eyes were all puffy from crying. I was just, like, I'm in this terrible place in my life. And I'm saying to her, like, I don't know what to do, because I'm promoting this book, but I'm going through this terrible time in life. And she said to me, why don't you blog about it? She says, you know, it'll be, like, it'll be really interesting. And I said, oh, I don't want to talk about my relationship that way and throw somebody in the fire. And she said, Tori, throw him in the fire. Really encouraging me to just go for it. And I can't do that. I just can't do that. I need that sort of retrospective time to look back on the past and make sense of it. I feel like if I were to blog my thoughts real time, it would just be quite awful to read. I tend to, like, for my blog, I tend to sort of try to put together pieces that have had a lot of thought in them, and I spend, each post is probably, you know, at least 8 hours it'll take me to write a piece, and and then when I feel like I've got something that's, like, worth sharing, then I put it out there. But I don't publish very often. I, you know, tend to publish sort of once every 2 weeks or even once a month. And the last post that I just put out, I've got an illustrator working with me now, and that took us, I can't even tell you, actually, I'd say that last post took us a week each.
So it's not like the just publish or perish kind of style of blogging. You're really looking at crafting, you know, additions to your body of work almost, yeah?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah, yep. And I find that that's a technique that, works well, because I end up getting offers from, sometimes, you know, publications want to republish a piece that I've written, or I'll get companies who want to work with me in some form or another. So it's sort of, I try to put pieces out there that just best represent my writing, and rather than just the sort of, you know, diary style of platform building. Okay. So, yeah.
All right. So that was going to be my next question, in that we discussed earlier that you, even when you self, you know, published in 2011, you already had a platform, you know, that you'd been working on. You had social media, you had, you know, different things in place. Is that something that you've thought about right from the beginning, or has it evolved over time, or how has that worked for you?
Yeah, so I'd actually, with the first book, I had finished my manuscript by the time I actually started my platform building. So I got to the very end of writing a book and thought, okay, what now? How do I actually get this published? And I could start reading articles, and they say, like, publishers like it when you have a platform. So I'm like, okay, what is a platform? really like I had a dummy's guide. Like seriously,
the information is all there, and it's exactly what you need to do, isn't it? It's like, okay, that's what they say I need. How do I do that? Oh, there's the information I need, and you basically do it step by step that way, don't you?
You do exactly. So I really just figured it out from the ground up, and you know, started a Twitter account. Like, what's Twitter? And how do you do this? And you know, I just figured it all out from the inside out. And I mean, it happened quite quickly. I guess if you dedicate yourself a lot of time to it, then and time to figuring out what's working and what's not working, and you know, if you have the luxury of that time, then yeah, you can build it from scratch pretty quickly. So I think that it took me February. It took me about 8 months between when I opened all my accounts and my blog and everything to when I self-published and sold the rights. So it, like 8 months of blogging, like it wasn't a huge, it wasn't no. like I had to do, you know, 7 years of platform building.
Yeah. It's pretty extraordinary still though. Like, I mean, your story is very fairy tale-y from that perspective, because I think a lot of people do work a lot harder for a lot longer to get, you know, anything near the results that you got with that particular book, which just goes to show you that the right book at the right time is always going to be, as long as you're in the right place, is always going to be there, isn't it? So
that's right.
Do you actually enjoy, like, when you did the self-publishing and do you, like, and you know, now that you've got your digital form of your new memoir out there, do you enjoy the work that goes into indie publishing, like beyond the writing? Do you actually enjoy the promotion and the, you know, getting the look right and all of that sort of stuff?
It's kind of a yes and no answer, because on one hand, it really motivates me, because I'm not sitting around waiting for anybody else to make decisions. I know that, like, I am the driver, and that independence really is quite motivating. And I found that when I sold the book traditionally, I just sort of, I was sitting around in this void of like, what do I do now? Like, I'm just sort of waiting for phone calls and stuff. Like, it's quite a powerless position to be in when you're traditionally published, because you don't know what your sales look like or what your publicity schedule is going to look like, or like whether people are working hard for you or not working hard for you. Like, you're in the dark. So I quite like with indie publishing that you're not in the dark at all. You are, like, if you want to make this thing happen, you can make that thing happen. You know, you can make those phone calls and send those emails, and you can really just drive it fiercely forward. But it, God, it is a lot of work. It really, it's drag. And it's like it never ends, you know. So, you know, you'll be like, it's so easy to get into this pattern of obsession of just like laying there in bed at 2 a.m. thinking, oh, I should email this person because maybe they'll put me in touch with that person and then I can sell 3 more copies of my book.
Oh dear. Is there such a thing as a typical day for you? Like, what, how much, like, if you're looking at a day, how much of your day is sort of involved in writing? How much of it is involved in book promotion? How much of it is involved in, you know, whatever else you're doing?
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer to that, but it's very, I make it up as I go along. I try to just, you know, I improvise in a way that sort of I wouldn't pass on or recommend to anybody, because I think that it's probably better to actually set boundaries around time and to give dedicated blocks, but I end up just letting it all bleed in together and eventually it all somehow gets done. But I think this time, the second time around with this book, I have been very careful to not form that obsessive relationship that I had with the first one, where I do set boundaries. I do set time, like, you know, pretty much sort of 5 or 6 o'clock, unless I have an interview later at night, I try to just shut the computer and be done with it and not, you know, think about who I can be emailing and stuff like that. But yeah, my days are a bit scattered and go with the flow.
Fair enough. Now, I read another blog post you wrote, which I will also put in the show notes, which is called On Funding a Creative Life. And it's kind of pretty much about how you fund your writing by renting out a room/couch on Airbnb, which, you know, I feel is the basis of a new memoir. And I look forward to, I'm looking forward to it. Is the reality of a writing life much less glamorous than you imagined it would be?
I don't think I ever really imagined it for myself. My dad was a writer. He was a film and television writer, and nothing about it was glamorous. I mean,
You were there. You were well versed in it then.
Very stressed man, you know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And you know, our family income would go up and down. And it just wasn't something I looked up to and thought, that's what I want for my life.
And yet here you are.
I know. I mean, I feel like I just accidentally fell into it, and I was like, no, I guess I'm going to be a writer now. But I don't know. Like I hadn't really imagined anything for myself. But I got to say that it is a nice, for me, it's a really nice thing to have more than one income source. So I have, like I said, my background's in visual communication. So I still do a bit of design work, because it pays really well, and it sort of gives me a little mental break from the intellectual process of writing. And then the Airbnb was just this way to earn like big chunks of money and know that my rent was going to be taken care of. And, you know, it's entirely possible that I could have made it, I could make it work just off writing alone. But I just don't like, I like the, to spread it around a little bit and know that I've got sort of safety nets in other areas, and that's just a thing that works for me.
Mm, okay. And are you actually working on a new project at the moment?
At the moment, I am working on a blog series that could lead to another book, but it's a bit of an experiment. So it's what I mentioned before. It's called The Illustrated Guide to Calming the F Down. It's made in collaboration with an illustrator who does this, you know, these wonderful cartoons, and she's and we just make this, I feel like it's like this wonderful creative marriage between minds. So I'm writing the pieces and she's doing the cartooning for them, and it centers around fear and anxiety, but I'm experimenting with the medium, like just blogging as a medium, and putting the cartoons in there and making it sort of this a therapy meets entertainment. So I'll see. I don't know where it'll lead, but we'll see.
Therapy as entertainment. I like it. All right. So we'll just finish up today by asking for your three top tips for writers.
Okay. Look, I think the first one, you know, the binders, the Facebook group binders, it's for women. That's an amazing group. So if you're a woman, I would definitely recommend joining binders. It's a huge community of female writers, and there's just tons of resources in there and tons of support. I didn't actually know about it until probably 8 months ago. So I'd highly recommend that. But there's one thing that I see people talking about in there a lot, and it's about the kind of anxiety of limbo state of waiting to find out if an agent will pick you up, or if, you know, getting replies from agents, or waiting to see if editors are going to pick up your book, or waiting to see what readers think of your book. And I think it's worth knowing from the beginning that writing is a very potentially anxiety-inducing life.
So true.
And so people come into this group saying like, oh, help me, I'm in this terrible state of waiting to see if agents, you know, want to work with me. And it's just like, God, get used to that feeling, because it does not end. It really does not end. Like, you're always waiting for the next kind of like round of approval from someone somewhere. So you just have to find a way to kind of be okay in limbo land all the time.
So true.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't think I have a third thing.
Must be one. Come on. Let's talk about your actual writing process. Do you just sit down and blurt it all out in a draft and then go back and edit, or how do you do that? Let's look at Tori's tips for getting the writing done.
Yeah, I'm very, very unstructured, and I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm in the minority with that. So, I mean, I guess you see a lot of writing tips around for people saying, you know, just show up and do the work and sit down at 9 o'clock and, you know, write until 5 and get it done. And I think that that's awesome. But for me, it's really aspirational. It's just not how it works for me. Like, I am sort of a bit fluid in my approach and a bit unpredictable. And there are days where if I were to force myself to try and write, I feel like it would almost be damaging, because I'm just not in the mental space for it, and so for me, like, I do try to go with the flow a little bit more, and I think it's a different personality type. I think that kind of messier kind of people who maybe live life on more of a whim or who are impulsive, probably perhaps would prefer that unstructured approach. And I think if you try to apply typical like structured writing advice to that type of personality, that's just not the best advice. So,
no, yeah. I think you have to learn how you write and go with that.
Yeah, yep, I agree. Hmm.
See, you did have a third one right there.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Tori, and best of luck with the new memoir. I will put the links to your website and also to The Fearful Adventurer and also to your blog posts that we've mentioned in the show in the show notes. So have a look for those because they are actually terrific posts and really worth having a look at. And, we will wait to see what happens next. It's bound to be interesting.
Thank you so much, Alison. It's been really nice chatting.
This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our Stage 2 Creative Writing course, Advanced Fiction Writing Techniques, will help you apply proven methods to your own writing, taking your storytelling to a whole new level. With workshopping and practical exercises focusing on scene development, characters, climax, and resolution, it's your perfect next step. Learn online over a few hours each week. You'll even get your own tutor providing personal feedback on your writing. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/advanced.
Tori DeRoche, very cool interview, Al. What a great story.
Well, she's such an interesting person, you know, because she's so, she's sort of so calm and, she talks about the fact that she's sort of not, she's very, you know, she talks about the fact that she kind of writes when she feels like it. It's all very much, you know, come as it is with her. And I like her attitude. And I love the fact that she wrote the post about having to, you know, she basically, to support her writing, she rented out a room on Airbnb. And as I said to her, I feel like there's probably, you know, a new book in that at some point down the track. But yeah, she's really interesting. And her blog is absolutely lovely. The new series that she's doing with the illustrator is really quite beautiful. And she's just a really interesting person. She's kind of just going about her business. And I think that's a really nice way to be.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So what's happening with you this week, Al, apart from surviving the school holidays?
Well, you know, pretty much that at the end of the day is what will happen. I'm actually going to be we've got a few bookshops. We're going to visit some bookshops to sign books, the boys and I. Excellent. And so we'll be doing that. And we've got, just bits and pieces. Like as I think we've discussed in the past, I tend to try to sort of take it fairly easy. Interestingly, I did start writing something new last week that's kind of gripped me
a little bit.
So I did. So I'm working on that and I'm still working on my sort of I've got a few projects on the go at the moment, and I'm just I'm kind of taking it a little bit easy with those. I'll probably go back into, you know, full on mode come November for NaNoWriMo. I'll work out which one of these things that I'm doing I really want it the most to get finished. So I'll probably do that in November. But at the moment, I'm just I'm taking it all a bit day by day because I am still doing quite a lot of promotional work for the Book of Secrets and also for the Mapmaker Chronicles in the US. I've had quite a few guest posts come out in the last week, so I'm kind of, you know, working on different things with that. And I'm just, I don't know, like it's one of those things where you've just pretty much got to slot things in, work out your routine and do what you can when it's school holidays, because that's the only way to go forward.
Awesome. You sound busy.
Always. And you, what are you doing?
What am I doing? I'm not getting on a plane, train or automobile this week. Oh, well, I'll get into automobiles, obviously, but no flying around like I did last week, which is good because I find that I get all unhealthy and I eat too much and you know how it is.
Yeah, I do.
Yes. So a bit of catching up, but that should be good. We've got everyone back in the office. There have been a few people who've been on leave, but now everyone's back and it's going to be good. So there you go. We will be singing Hamilton in our breaks.
Hamilton.
Are you still singing Hamilton?
Not only are we still singing Hamilton, we have found on Spotify the instrumental version. So that's essentially Hamilton karaoke.
Oh, no.
So we put on Hamilton karaoke and we go crazy.
Do you take different parts? Like, does everyone get a role to play in the musical, or do you? How does that work?
It's happened like just by accident, as in we don't assign certain parts. People just sort of gravitate to certain parts and end up singing those. It's all been very organic, but it's worked out very well.
Will there be a live Facebook performance of this at any stage, just to kind of keep us all entertained or not so much?
Oh, you never know, right? You never know. There could be us up there rapping away. You never know.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll all be keeping an eye out for that, Valerie.
All right. So where do we find you online, Al?
You'll find me at alisontait.com, alisontait.com. And I've actually, in saying that, with school holidays in mind, there's quite a few posts on there at the moment about kids and creativity, kids and writing that, you know, parents who are kind of struggling with school holidays might find interesting. So I'm there, and you'll also find me on Twitter at altait, A-L-T-A-I-T. You will find me on Facebook and Instagram at alisontaitwriter. And you, Val?
You'll find me at Valerie Koo, that's K-H-O-O, on Twitter and Instagram. Oh, and of course, make sure you all join the Facebook group for listeners of So You Want to Be a Writer. All you need to do is go to Facebook and search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community and join. It's an awesome place. So many cool people in there, all sorts of fantastic discussions about writing, and that's where you can connect with us as well and ask your questions. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we look forward to chatting to you again next time. Are you going to say bye, Al?
Oh,
bye.
Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. Of course, you can find all the show notes at soyouwanttobeawriter.com.au. To find out more about the courses at the Australian Writers' Centre, go to writerscentre.com.au, where you'll find lots of fabulous resources and courses that are going to help you in your writing. Now, congratulations to those people who made it to the Easter egg last time. Thought I'd include another Easter egg this time as well, just to see how many of you get to this point. What can I share with you? I have been reading. Somebody did request to find out what we're reading. So I have been reading Steve Bisley's memoir. Now, I'm just going to reach for it. It's called All the Burning Bridges, and it's out in October. And to me, it was a page-turner, to be honest. And I just read it from cover to cover, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Probably not the usual thing that I would pick up, but I'm really glad I did. It was a great read, and I'm going to look forward to chatting to Steve Bisley about it soon, hopefully. I am watching Top of the Lake China Girl, which is the Jane Campion miniseries that is on at the moment, and I'm really enjoying it. Elizabeth Moss is so fantastic. She's evolved so much as an actor. I remember watching her play the president's teenage daughter on The West Wing, and now she's in hit role after hit role and proving herself to be such a fantastic actor. Slightly strange New Zealand Australian accent that she's trying to master, but you know, it's a great series and lots of fantastic acting in there. I am shocked by the recent announcement by Nikon for their ambassadors of their D850 camera, and they posted a photo of all the ambassadors, and there were 32 men, and they were all men. And I guess for somebody who is co-host of a podcast called So You Want to Be a Photographer, that's my other podcast, and I'm not professing to be a fantastic photographer, but I am quite immersed in the world of photography, and I co-host with one of Australia's top photographers who happens to be female. And I know that there are a lot of fantastic female photographers out there. So I'm really surprised that Nikon have done this, where 32, you know, not just one or two, it wasn't just a list of three, it was a list of 32 of their ambassadors, and they were all guys. I am loving that summer is here. Have you seen the weather lately in Sydney? It's incredible, and I'm so looking forward to daylight saving. I love daylight saving, and it just makes me happy. Anyway, hope you guys have a great week, and I'll chat soon.